may run a little late. I just want you to know that I started at 2:41. So, but who's counting? I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since March 22nd of 1985, and for that I am truly grateful. It's my wife has 5.5 months more than I do, and she likes to make a big deal out of it. But she's not here tonight, and some people have asked where Katie was, and Katie was a jazzercise franchisee for over 30 years, and went all over. She's kind of a powerhouse in that company, and she went all over the world speaking to them and stuff, and they're having their 50th anniversary out in San Diego. She's been retired for 8 years, but they asked her out as an honored guest, so she sends her regards and says she really wishes that she could be here, but I'm looking forward to getting this going. My home group is a primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin, Texas. We meet on Tuesday nights. It's a line-by-line big book study meeting. We study the big book line-by-line, week after week, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. There was a time where it would have been like, again this week? I don't know, But we have over 200 people on a Tuesday night studying the big book, I like to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is making a big comeback in AA these days, I came in during the discussion meeting era and that sort of thing, but my sponsor is a guy named Myers, and some of you know, and before that, my sponsor was a guy named Mark Houston, and I promise you, God bless Mark Houston. I always think this is the talk I'm going to be able to mention Mark's name without weeping, but we'll see how it goes. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank anybody who had anything to do with being here. And there's one thing that I think is worth mentioning. Besides planning all this stuff, April and Dylan have a 2-week-old baby. So that means they've been doing all this stuff either while she was super pregnant or not getting any sleep, So bravo. I just had a baby girl, and I want to thank Fred and Heather. They picked us up at the airport, and Fred only almost killed us once, but I loved it. Guys, we don't think we should get in trouble if we weren't trying to hurt you. You'll see that we may talk about that in the men's process, but he almost, I'm going, look out, look out, look out, look out. And he goes, I was looking at the thing. I'm like, not particularly concerned with what you were looking at. I'm just telling you. Telling you about to kill us, and then that gift bag in the room was amazing. But I've got a lot of ground to cover. But I do want to make a special. Where's Jody? Jody gets our furthest travel award. She's here from Sydney, Australia. So. And I want to make a special mention of my new friend, Anjanette. We met yesterday, and I said, what are you doing sitting way back here, girl? And we talk about how much you learn in these workshops. In one day, she's moved from the 14th row to the 4th row. So but she's been sober since December, and I'm glad you're here. And I hope you hear some stuff that you hear this weekend. And a lot of people have mentioned John I'm a huge fan of the Tapers. I think the Tapers are our archivists, and I'm just super glad that everything's going on. And I'm 1 minute past where I thought I wanted to be with the hello and howdies. So because let me tell you something. I love this format, chapters in recovery and that sort of thing. But, Bob talked about it being a daunting task. I mean, I've been giving a lot of thought to this topic. I've been doing a lot of, prep work in my mind and on notes and then inviting God into, what are we going to talk about? And I said, because, when they're given a chapter, I was given the chapter into action. Well, I'm glad it wasn't to employers or something like that, as I'm thinking, this will be great, and then you're going, wait a minute, that means I've got a little over 60 minutes to talk about steps 5, steps 6 and 7, steps 8 and 9, and 10 and 11. Other than that, I'll just juggle the rest of the time, So here we go, because, and I'm going to reference back to a lot of what Bob said, but but after step three, it says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. And for a long time to me, that course of vigorous action was the fourth step, or the fourth step and the fifth step. And you know, Katie talks about this thing, this golf swing, how the vigorous course of action is, and it's really like four through nine. You know, that we do the inventory, and then we do the fifth step, and we take it into six and seven, and we go out and clean it up. And that's really this vigorous course of action that it talks about in the book. But, you know, I mean, you hear people talk a lot about how quick do you work the steps? How long does it take somebody to go through the steps? And I don't even know what the answer is. It takes me about, you know, at least five meetings to take a guy through the steps. You know, we spend about an hour doing steps one and two. You know, talking about my first job is to give them a fatal dose of alcoholism, what it really means to have this hopeless state of mind and body that we're talking about having recovered from. And then we do about an hour on step three. After that first meeting, I let them consider it. When I come back, I get a commitment from them, and we do the third step, and we line them out on writing inventory. And, you know, but there's one thing that's kind of interesting to me anyway. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that when they come over to my house with their fourth step, and we're going to sit down and do their fifth step at evening, that day we're going to do their fifth step, they're going to do step six and seven, they're going to go home and make a list, and at that night they'll be on steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. You know, I mean, it's this golf swing of the biggest course of action can really, and that's what we'd like to do at our group, is really study what the book is saying. What did they find important to put in there, and in what order? You know, and then try to have that experience and then carry that message. I'm looking at Kelly, reminds me what a great job you did last night. And I want to thank the speakers that have come before me. Thanks. Don't clap. I need those seconds. You know, so. But, you know, I think if there's one of the things that I find, you know, kind of interesting about my story is, I had my biggest spiritual awakening when I was 17 years sober. You know, so when I talk, you know, talks about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, I really kind of need to talk about what I was like, what happened, and then what happened, and what I'm like now. Because I had one experience in AA for the first 17 years I was sober, and there was a lot of stuff going on in there, and I was basically working a program like the problem was alcohol, and then there was a plane crash in there that you have to get a hold of another talk sometime to hear a whole lot of my story, because I got seven steps to cover. But you know, but then what's happened since then? So since then, I don't have time to really lay a whole bunch of this out technically and tell a whole bunch of story with it. Sometimes I think it's interesting to talk about what is significantly different in the way I approach AA now compared to the way I was doing it back then. You know, so a lot of things were different. You know, and one big mistake that was made for me, Bob talked about the A, B, and C, you know, that it contains the first two steps. And one of the biggest mistakes I see being made in AA, if there are any mistakes being made in AA, is taking a guy right from C that God couldn't, what if he, so basically we say, are you alcoholic? Yes. Do you believe in God? Well, however we have to get to that. And if he says yes, we're going to get you down on your knees and do the third step prayer. And it was my experience the first time through the steps, and it's a pretty common experience in AA, you know. And but if you do that, if you go right from C, God could, and what if you saw it, to the third step prayer, you skip this body of work that Bob did such a great job of covering before lunch, but between pages 60 to 63. And it's really not that important. It's just the root of our problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life. You know, other than that, you can just skip it, you know. And it says on page 60, it says the first requirement is that we must be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I remember the first time I saw that. I don't know when the first time I ever read it was. I don't know if this happens in Florida, but one of the reasons that we do the set-aside prayer in Texas is because I don't always look for new information when I'm reading stuff. It's what we call a confirmation bias. I'm not looking for new information. I'm looking for confirmation of ways that I'm already right. You know, so I'm just reading the book going, mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. No, yeah. That's, I always say that, you know. And then I'm like, Jay Walker. And I'm like, so you can't tell me anything about this line. I've already got it highlighted and underlined, you know. And so what happens is anything that's new information just goes right past me. And one day, I'm working with Mark, and I had 17 years sober, and I'm reading the book, and I get to page 60. And it says the first requirement is that any life run on self, that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I remember thinking, not only was I never convinced of that, that line never touched me. And the way you would have been able to tell that I wasn't convinced, we believe in our sponsorship list, Peter and I had the same sponsor. And one of the things we talk about is turning statements in the big book into questions, you know. And so when we come to things, it's just like the first requirement is that I be convinced. I ask myself, am I convinced of this? Is this my current belief based on my experience and what this book is saying? And the way you would have been able to tell that I wasn't convinced that my life run on self-will could hardly be a success would have been by following me around. You know, if you follow me around, does this guy seem like a guy that's convinced his life run on self-will can hardly be a success? Or does this seem like here's a guy that thinks now that you got the booze and the dope off of me, I'll take it from here. Yeah. Right? And that's what happens. You know, the 12 and 12 says that we can have faith in God and still keep him out of our lives. And the way that shows up for me is I'm like, oh, yeah, God's awesome. God's awesome. I mean, God took care of my drinking and everything. No, I don't need him for this deal with Katie. You know, and I don't need him for this thing with the IRS. And I don't need him for this thing at work. And we do a little exercise we call current agnosticism at the table where we talk about what are areas of your life that you're not bringing God into. And we had the guys there from Colorado one time. We were getting ready to go to this man-to-man conference, and we did a current agnosticism exercise. We went around, we said, everybody write down three areas of your life that you're not bringing God into. And this one guy I really like from Aspen, he goes, my God. And we're like, what? He goes, well, the three areas of my life that I'm not bringing God into are my job, my kids, and my marriage. And we're like, but other than that, nothing big, right? You know, I mean, it's like, and we don't know it because I fall asleep and I don't know it, you know. And before long, God consciousness drops down, my self-will rises up, and before you know it, God doesn't have anything to do with it, and it's just me, and I'll take care of it. And even in meditation, sometimes God starts to sound a lot like me, you know. So when we, this chapter into action starts off by telling me what have we been trying to do up to now. It says we've been trying to get a new attitude, right? It says a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. Really? Is that what we've been doing? You know, because, you know, and it says we've admitted certain defects. When did we admit these certain things? In this fourth step that Bob was talking about. You know, about taking this stuff into the columns and seeing it from an entirely different angle. Now, and you know, because when I'm doing inventory with the guy, I hope I get a chance to. I got to tell you before I go much further. The reason I have to write stuff down is because I have a brain that loves to go on bunny trails and tangential thoughts. And I got an attention span like a 12-year-old, you know. And there are times where I'll say, we're going to get back to that later. And what that means is this ain't the appropriate time in the talk to cover that piece of information. Right? But when I tell you we're coming back to it, we're probably not coming back. You know? So it says we've admitted certain defects. You know, we've admitted certain. Now, it says we've admitted certain defects. I got bad news. There's more defects coming, you know. I mean, you know, it's like we're going to cover the ones I covered in inventory, but there's more coming, you know. When I was in college, there was a school newspaper at the University of Texas, and one time they had this little gag article from the psychology department. It was supposed to be from the psychology department, and it was advertising workshops that you could sign up for. But they were gagged topics. But the one that really caught my eye was it said, dealing with post-self-awareness depression. Think about that one for a minute, you know. It's what Bob was talking about, how we just get reduced a little bit and a little bit, a little bit. You're going, wow, all that, you know. So it says we have ascertained. That's a word you don't throw around in conversation very much. What does ascertain? It means to make certain, to find out definitely through test and examination. So we've ascertained what? In a rough way, what the trouble is. So in this inventory, we've kind of figured out in a rough way what the trouble is. And the root of my trouble is selfishness and self-centeredness. Bob did such a beautiful job of covering that, and that's not every conversation in Alcoholics Anonymous, that self piece. That's, it changed my sobriety. That's the biggest thing. If you said, what's the biggest thing that's happened since you had that awakening in 17 years? I'm 34 years sober now, but what's the biggest? It would be the self piece. It would be that, because now it's not just drink, don't drink. It was, because that's kind of a pass-fail basis, but now it's like in the manifestations of self, and how do I show up, and how do people experience me, and what's it like to work for me, what's it like to work with me, what's it like to be married to me, what's it like for me to be your dad, your brother, your that sort of thing, because it gives me a whole lot of stuff to work with, and so, because on there, on page 62, it says, above everything, we have to be rid of this selfishness. And Mark Houston was the one that looked me dead in the eye, sitting there at my table. God dang. I'm telling you, the message that was delivered to me through Mark Houston changed my life. And the lives of many others since then. I told Peter, I said, I so envy these people that can cry and talk. There's some people that can cry and keep talking. Let me tell you, I'm either talking or I'm crying. It's all a stop until it passes, but I'm okay. But Mark looked me dead in the eye one day when we were doing that piece of the work, and he goes, Charlie, it says above everything, we have to be rid of this selfishness. And he goes, what do the words above everything mean to you? Talk about turning statements into questions. I was like, well, I guess it means like paramount importance, And he goes, isn't it interesting that it doesn't even say above everything we got to stop drinking vodka? Turns out vodka never was my problem. Vodka was the only thing I'd ever found that would ease the discomfort of a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness. And that's why I get so uncomfortable that I eventually need relief again and that sort of thing. So it says, it's interesting. On 60, it says the first requirement is that I be convinced. And when we get over there and we start to write that inventory on 64, it says something interesting. It says being convinced of what? Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. So am I convinced of that? And if over on page 60 it says the first requirement is that I be convinced, and on 64 it says being convinced, that tells me that somewhere in those pages 60 to 63, its job has been to convince me of what this, that I really am, got no, that I really do have no shot on the basis of self-will, and that's just a whole lot of what's going on with me. So, one of the things I think about sometimes is if I'm working with a new guy, I say guys because I work with guys, but when I talk to a new guy and we're talking about it, selfishness and self-centeredness, they nod their head like they know what we're talking about. They don't know what we're talking about. And the reason I know that is because at 34 years sober, I'm still blown away by the level of self-centeredness that comes out of this thing. Sometimes you ever have your first reaction to something and you just like go, ooh. Wow. I was talking to Jackie, I think. I was talking to Jackie before the meeting about, if you don't think you got any lingering self-centeredness, how'd you like to have a loudspeaker hooked to your brain that just broadcasts every thought you have as you're moving through the world? It's like, wow, that's ugly, so we got this new guy, and he's going, okay, if you're telling me that self is the problem, I don't get it. I don't understand what you're talking about. I don't know what am I supposed to be looking for? What is self, And the book says, okay, it's a fair question for this guy to ask me. What are we looking for? And then it goes on, and it says, being convinced that self manifests in various ways was what it defeats, we considered the common manifestations of self. So that's what we're doing now in the inventory, is looking at the common ways that self shows up. And it shows up in resentment, as a manifestation of self. It shows up, fear shows up as the failure of self-will, and then manifestations of self when the sexual instinct is aroused. And I've taken way too long on this stuff, but we cover those things, and now we're looking for the way self shows up. And so it says we put our finger on the weak items in our inventory. That's what we've done in this thing. And it says, now these are about to be cast out. Now we're back into this into action. And there's a warning here. It says, in actual practice, we find that a solitary self-appraisal is usually insufficient. That's too bad, because I love a solitary self-appraisal. One of the problems I have is when I'm grading my own papers, and Bob talked about it, in the third step, I have these motives, right? My motives are always good. And that's what I was talking about when Fred was, is that with boys, I don't know what it is, but we always think we shouldn't be in trouble if we didn't intend to hurt your feelings. Katie will come to me and she'll go, honey, you really hurt my feelings in front of everybody there last night. And I go, but I wasn't trying to hurt your feelings, honey. I was just, and she's like, look in here. Look right in here. You see anybody gives a flip what you were trying to do? And she's like, I'm telling you, you hurt my feelings, And you're like, but I didn't mean to, And it's, so that's how driven I am by my motives. And then I've also got that delusion that Bob talked about, that if everybody would have just acted right, if I could have just got you people to cooperate, everything would have been great. So I come into all this stuff thinking my problems. The biggest movement I can take a guy through in recovery is from his problems are coming at him to that his problems are coming from him. That's what comes out of it. I start to see that I think that my outward conditions are what governs my inward situation, but it's always my outward circumstances are always a manifestation of my inward condition. I keep thinking if I can just get everything straightened out here, I'll be okay in here. And the book speaks completely opposite to it, So if I can't do a solitary self-appraisal, I got to pick somebody else. And it talks about picking somebody else. And it says, in trying to avoid this step, we turn to easier methods. Some of us turn, oh boy, am I a fan of easier methods? easier methods can, the problem with easier methods is anything that will calm this unrest that I have inside of me creates another 12-step program, It's like you try food, you try gambling, you try pornography, you try, obsessively collecting things, you try making money, having kids, whatever it is, and I don't think there's a 12-step fellowship for having too many babies, but there's some instructions there, and then it says, we have no right to save our own skin at the expense of someone else when we're picking this person to do our fifth step with. And that carries over into the 10th step too. It's like, you can't come to me. It'd be like, imagine somebody wants to come to a 10th step with me on my sponsor, right? I don't need to hear that, or come to me to complain about Katie. They're not going to like the reaction they get, or come to me to do a inventory on my daughter. It's like, no, you need to save those parts. You ever have somebody come make amends to you? Like, my favorite one is when they come and go, hey, man, I don't want to apologize to you because I've really talked a lot of smack about you, and I'm really sorry. And you're like, oh, good, yeah. Now you feel better. I got to go write inventory, The rule is we're hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And so apparently, when we get in the amends process, we're not others. That's the other watered down crap I hear in the meetings where they say, well, it says in the amends step that except when they do so would injure them or others, and I'm part of others, so I don't have to make that amends. And you're just like, figuratively. So what are the qualities we're looking for in a fifth step? It says it's important that they be able to keep a confidence, that they understand and approve of what I'm driving at, and that they won't try to change my plan. Now, this was written back when they didn't have all these meetings and all these sponsors. It's just so if you go to a priest or somebody, they didn't need somebody that's going to say, oh, you don't need to do all that. It says that they'll approve what I'm driving at and understand, and they won't try to change my plan. So it says we explain to our partner what we're about to do and why. That's a stumper. What are we about to do? and why when we show up with our foreskin in our hands? Mark asked me that question one time. I did not have a ready answer. And he said, we're trying to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which are blocking us. You know, we make this deal back in the third step where it says, I'm no longer in management. I'm going to quit playing God, you know. But it says, the deal I make with God in step three, it says, being all powerful, he'll provide what I need. That's his job under two circumstances. If I stay close to him and perform his work well. So his job is to provide what I need. My job is to stay close to him and perform his work well. Interesting thing is, from there on out, there really ain't nothing else. Everything we do from that point on is either about staying close to him or performing his work well. Because when we get into the inventory process, I can't stay close to this power unless I get close to this power. And I can't get close to this power if I'm blocked. I always picture this pipeline, and God's on one end of it, and I'm on the other. And my pipe is clogged up with resentment and fear, remorse and guilt and worry and pride and fear and all this stuff. And what we're going to try to do in the process is at least remove enough of what's blocking me that there can be some flow of grace between me and this power. So there's not a lot of instructions on hearing a fifth step. You know, when you're going to hear a fifth step, there's not just a ton of instructions in the big book on how to hear a fifth step. Most of the instructions come in the fourth step, especially on pages 66 and 67, because in the into action it says, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Now, that is one little interesting thing. I called up a buddy of mine one time, who's quite the big book technician, and I said, I like the term big book. I don't know whether I'm a big book thumper, big book technician, step worker, whatever you want to call it, but I love the book, and I love the instructions in the book, and I love the effect that it produces. But I said, I'm pretty checked out on the technical approach to the fourth step, what we do and when, and, you know, that, the fear, the resentment inventory, the fear inventory, the sex inventory. But I said, where's the piece where we talk about the take it to the grave stuff? Where's the, what's the thing you've decided you're not going to tell me already? You know, what is this thing that you've decided you're going to take? And he said, well, it's in the fifth step. He says, in the fifth step, it says illuminating, that means shining light upon every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. So now, obviously there's more. I used to think my job when I was here in the fifth step was to listen to you read your fourth step. And now I'm seeing it a lot differently. You know, over there, it's in the on page 64, it says a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing mission. I used to think, now I see my job is that my job as a sponsor is the fact-finding, and his job is the fact-facing. Because when I'm coming with my inventory, I'm not capable always of being able to see it from an entirely different angle. I need somebody to show it to me from an entirely different angle. So when I'm hearing inventory, I feel like a news reporter sometimes. When I'm hearing inventory, I'm going, one of my favorites was this guy Roy, and I don't know if I got time to talk about Roy, but we'll see. Because we talk about this fact, and so like Roy came to me ahead of us. I'm going to try to tell this really fast. I always say that Peter could give my talk in 20 minutes. I wish I could talk that fast. But Roy comes to me one time, and in his inventory, he says, who's the resentment at? My dad. What did he do? Well, when I was 12, I was sitting on the front steps of the house, and my dad pulled up, and he came walking by me, and he says, your mom killed herself today. And he goes in the house. And he's like, it affected this, it affected that. And the thing is, how could anybody be that heartless? How could anybody be that thoughtless? And you could get a lot of support from that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You poor thing, he shouldn't have done it. We took a little different approach to it. I'm on this fact-finding and fact-facing mission. I go, so let me ask you a few questions. I go, so how many kids were in your family? And he says, three. And where were you? He was 12. And where were you in these three kids? I was in the middle. And your parents were still together? And he goes, yeah. And I go, how was the money situation? And he goes, well, it was okay. I mean, my dad was a welder. We weren't like, over it, but we were okay. And so I go, so now your mom has had a history of mental illness, I guess. And he goes, yeah. And there have been a lot of scenes in the past and a lot of crazy stuff. And he goes, yeah. And so now when Bob talked about that sick man exercise of looking at it from an entirely different angle, I start looking at role reversal. And when he says, you know, we ask that person, are you willing to look at this from an entirely different angle? And I said, you know, given what we've talked about here, I said, you know, so let me get this straight. I said, so you're 12. I'm guessing your dad's in his mid to late 30s. And he goes, yeah. And I go, he's a welder. He's from a small town in Texas. He's got a wife that has a history of mental illness now, and there's been a lot of drama and stuff in the house, and he's been trying to hold everything together. There's been a lot of drama in the past, and on this day, his wife has successfully killed herself. Now, he's got to leave work. He's got to come home, and he's got to notify everybody in this little town that his wife committed suicide. He's got to notify the whole family that his wife killed herself. He's got to he's got to risk all that judgment and stuff from these people. And in the meantime, he's got to try to figure out how to make a living and raise three children as a widower. Is it possible that given his background and the tools he had for living and where he came from and what's driving him, is it possible that when he walked by and said, your mom killed herself today, that was the best he could do that day? That he wasn't trying, and he goes, it's my favorite thing to hear in the fourth column on inventory. He goes, oh my God. Mark used to talk about that the fourth column in the inventory turns the second column into a lie. And the first time he said that, I was like, what is he even talking about? I saw the second column happen. I wouldn't be writing it down if it didn't happen. But here's the thing where we do this sick man, this compassion exercise. We look at it from their angle. We consider what was going on. Because when I screw up, I don't want to talk about my motives and my delusion. But when you screw up, it's just an outrage and I demand justice. You know. So this is the first time. He goes, my God, I never considered my dad for a minute. I've been waiting 40 years for my dad to come apologize to me. I need to go find my dad tomorrow and apologize to him. And I watched a 40-year resentment just go, just like that. That's the power of that compassion exercise that Bob was talking about. And that's a whole lot of what I take into here in inventory when I'm talking to God. And over and over and over again, you know, with this entirely different angle. I like role reversal, too. A lot of times I'll talk about, you know, I'll see something happen and I go, I could have been anybody in that little beef. You know, I could have been the guy behind the counter. I could have been the guy in front of the counter. You know, I mean, because there are times where you go, you know, on the wrong day, I could have been anybody in this little thing. And it gives me a little more compassion for this person behind the counter. And you know, so I also like to listen to old ideas when I'm hearing inventory. I listen, you know, and one of the things I really like to look for is conflicting old ideas, you know, because you got a guy and he's talking about, well, he's clear in this resentment how my mom and dad fell short. You know, they should have parented this way and they didn't, and here's what happened. And then he goes, so that's the way parents should act. And they go, yeah. You go, Bob talked about this. And then you go, well, is that the way you parent? And you're like, well, no, you just did some kind of ninja flip on me there, you know. I liked it better when it's a lot easier to get somebody to forgive their parents when they've had children. You know, because I don't know about you, but with my children, my hope with my children is that they will look at the body of my parenting and go, Dad was a pretty cool guy, and and it will be willing to overlook the isolated incidents where I was a complete butthole. That's a spiritual term right out of the big book. But I do exactly the opposite with my parents. I pick out the isolated incidents where they showed up poorly and disregard the whole body of their work. So we can kind of bring that together in the inventory processes. Where do I have double standards and that sort of thing? What happens in the process of all this, it'll start bringing awareness to these resentments. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of us go into this thinking that I need a lot of forgiveness for all these things that have happened to me. And it's amazing how the more awareness I get of how delusional and self-seeking and selfish I am in this stuff, I need to be handing out a lot less forgiveness and I need to be asking for a lot more forgiveness. You know, it's like it changes my whole perspective on this thing. But you know, before I get out of the fifth step, one of the things I want to be sure and say is don't wait until you can do this stuff perfectly. If you got somebody that's going through the steps, sit down with them and do a fifth step, because it's my firm belief that if a sponsor and the sponsee are both giving it their best shot, that God takes up a ton of slack in that deal. You know, so this is on-the-job training. We learn as we go and that sort of thing. But at the end of the fifth step, we get to this hour at the end of it. Oh, my God. You got 25 minutes to cover the other six steps. When we get to the end of the fifth step, we come home and we spend this hour. I want to say this really fast because this is a huge piece of work that I didn't always do for a long time. I used to just kind of phone in this hour. But it says going home, it says we find a place where we can be quiet, carefully reviewing what we've done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Now, I'm not exactly sure why my book's on a shelf if I'm just doing my fourth step. But I tell my guys, put it up on a shelf and then take it back down again. You know, it's a completely ridiculous exercise, and I insist on it. You know, and so, but it says carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything. And it gives these questions, you know, as our work saw it so far. But now when I go in and I do that hour now, I really am looking, I'm looking at the first five steps in all their implications. And I'm going, am I bodily and mentally different from my fellows? Am I crushed by this self-imposed crisis? Are my choices really just to live life on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death? Do I have a physical allergy that triggers a phenomenon of craving that I have no power over once I've taken a drink? And coupled with that, do I have a mental obsession that makes it impossible for me to stay without a drink in any long period of time? And over the period of time, am I going to drink till I have to stop and stop till I have to drink? And have I become convinced that the only answer that will take me out of that is the power of God working in my lives? And have I made this decision, and you know, when we get into the third step, have I understood what self-will means? Am I the actor running the whole show? Do I have this, you know, am I always this delusion that if everybody would just acted right, it would have been okay? And am I a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And selfishness, self-centeredness, have I seen example after example after example of it in the inventory process? And when we come out, I mean, now all of a sudden this hour turns into a serious piece of work. And I'm sitting there going, wow, I am in just the right fellowship, you know. And it's after we've asked and answered these questions in the hour, it says, and we turn the page to 76, and it says that we then look at step six. You know, for a long time, one time Katie got asked to do a Woodstock format talk, and which is always great, really exciting, and then they said, we'd like for you to do six and seven. And when she's like, oh. And she went in and she goes to the taper. She goes, you know, I'm really a lot better at three. And she is. She's awesome at three. But so she comes out, and Lorenzo's there with us, and she goes, I talked to him to let me do three. And Lorenzo goes, oh, that's too bad. It would have been interesting to see where God took you with six and seven. So she marches back in there, you know, a producer of confusion rather than harmony, comes back. So we spend a lot of time looking at six and seven and talking about six and seven, you know, because most of us, frankly, if you said, hey, we'd like for you to give a talk on at the big deal this weekend, you're, oh, great. And they go, we need you to do an hour on six and seven. Most of us would run out of bullets after about 10 minutes, you know, so we started looking at what, and the way I see six and seven now, think of the stuff that's come out of this inventory and so many things that I see that are blocking me from God. And it says, after we've asked, we then look at step six, are we now ready to let God remove from us all these things which we have admitted are objectionable? That's what's come out of the inventory process. And it says, can he now take them all, every one? This speaks to my faith in this power. You know, not only can he take them, but will he take them? Do I believe that God has the power? Because, and then what I do when I get into the sixth, I have four things that I talk about in step six and seven. And what happens is, and this comes is going to come at you, but the first thing that I'm looking at, these things which you have admitted in the fourth step, are they objectionable to me? Let me get a little drink. This stuff that I've become aware of now, are they objectionable to me? It's really a piece of business when it becomes objectionable. I see that this is the real problem. And if they're objectionable to me, do I have the power to change them on my own? And if I don't have the power to change, if they're objectionable to me and I don't have the power to change them on my own, the third piece is, am I willing to let God change these things in whatever way he sees fit? I don't get to instruct the Creator on how I think this ought to go, right? You know, I'm surrendered. I don't have the power to change it. I'm willing to let God change it in whatever way that he sees fit. And if those three things are in place, I take it to God in the seventh step. And I say, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And it says we've then completed step seven, right? Now, this is where this comes in handy, is you're going to be able to use this throughout your sobriety. Because one of the things that you notice after you hang around here for a while is you're feeling pretty good, feeling pretty clean, you know, and then all of a sudden there's a little problem out on the horizon. Not much of a problem, just kind of a little problem. But, you know, and as it gets closer, you start going, oh, this is, by God, I think this might be a problem, you know. And, you know, and then before you know it, it's like, it's on you like that, you know. And that's when I take it, to this process of, do I admit it's objectionable? Do I have the power to change it? Because one of the things that I've come to know is that you get with God when things are difficult, but where you'll really come to trust the power of God is when things are impossible. And we come to this thing, and we go, wow, not only is this objectionable, but I can't do a damn thing about it. I've been trying to climb this hill for a while. And now I got to go to God and say, please take this from me. And this becomes a real piece of business. Six and seven. So the next thing comes to steps eight and nine. And it says, and you know, I keep waiting for the place where it says, you know, Charlie, this would be a good time to chill. You know, I mean, you know, do you have any friends with a boat or anything, you know? But it says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. And it's interesting. This is touchy, but stay with me. There's quotation marks around that faith without works is dead. That's because it's a quote from the Bible, from the book of James, chapter 2, verses 14 to 26. And, you know, so how about they're quoting outside literature in the big book? But basically what it says in that little passage is it says, watch my feet. You know, if you want to see what I believe, watch my feet. Don't listen to what comes out of my pie hole. You know, if I'm convinced, do I seem like somebody that's convinced? Would you be able to tell these are my beliefs if you followed me around? You know, so when we get over this, it says, in the eighth step, it says, we have a list of all persons we have harmed. Look, either have a list or make a list. But get a list, you know. I mean, I don't care where it comes from. But it says, now we go out to repair the damage done in the past. Now we're speaking to this self piece again. I missed the self piece in three. I missed the self piece in four, where it said we considered self's common manifestations. Talking about this confirmation bias. What did I do when I got to the amends process? And it says, we attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live life on self-will and run the show ourselves. Time to put his phone down. It says, we attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated. Nobody else heard that, right? Okay. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live life on self-will and run the show ourselves. Now, isn't it interesting? It doesn't say we go out and try to sweep away the debris of the damage done by my drinking. It says we're going to try to, now that we've seen awareness of self and we've carried it to God in six and seven, now we're going to go out and try to clean up the damage done by trying to live on self-will. How did I miss that theme for so long? I mean, it seems to me like the whole book is speaking to manifestations of self and that sort of thing. You know, and I want to talk a little bit about this experience I had with Mark Houston at the table. With Mark, I met Mark at a workshop weekend that him and another guy were putting on. And it was just, we were moved. Looking back on it, I can see that Katie and I were really just moved to this thing because we were 230 miles away. I'm not sure we would have been super fired up about a big book meeting, much less a weekend, you know, the whole thing. And to drive 230 miles, and what's crazy, Peter, when I played the tape later, of that weekend, Mark had taken a 3-year silence one time because he felt like he was getting too fried, and he took 3 years off without speaking. And when I played the CDs back of that weekend, Mark starts the weekend off by saying, "Wow, this will be interesting. I haven't done anything like this in about 3 years." And we're like, "Wow, I didn't hear that the first time he said it." But to think that he took me and Katie, he took Mark out of a 3-year silence and put us together in there, and looking back on it, seeing the ripple effect of what came out of that encounter and the way it's changed the lives of us and some of the people around us, it is a mind-blowing thing. But he comes, then he said he's going to move to Austin. And when he said he's going to move to Austin, I said, are you going to sponsor anybody locally? And he said, "I'm going to take 3. And I said, "Could I be one of them?" And he said, "Yeah." So I got 4 years of working with Mark, and before he passed away suddenly. But he comes over to the house, and I have this meeting at the house we call the Common Solution. I get my boys over there, and we want to be one voice, one message. Whoever you're talking to, you know, whether it's Todd or Chad or Jay or whoever it is, you should be getting essentially the same message from any of us. Common Solution, that sort of thing. So Mark comes over, and you know, you think, you know, hey, we got this new, you know, big deal AA guy, you know, what do you think's going to happen? You know, what do you think, we get with the new guy, what's the first thing you think you're going to do? You're thinking, well, we're probably going to write inventory, right? You know, we're probably going to write inventory. Every time anybody wants to go back through the work, they always want to write inventory. And Mark sits down at the table, and he's sitting there, and I'll never forget it. I can see the whole room in my mind, and he goes, "Where are you guys at with the amends process?" And we said, "What?" That's what an alcoholic says when they don't have an answer, you know, or a teenage boy, either one, you know. And so we go, "What?" And he goes, "Tell me about the amends. Tell me about your experience with the amends process." And I said, "Well, you know, I made amends to my mom and my sister and Delta Airlines and the IRS and Ford Motor Company and, you know, American Airlines and Sprint and, you know, all these people." But, you know, looking back on it, we call them the tornado amends. When we talk about, he read about us being a tornado roaring its way through the life. Well, I just made amends to the people that would first have been touched by that tornado. Mark is sitting there and he's listening to that, but I was amazed before I was halfway through. That's a big book joke. And Mark is sitting there and he goes, "I sense that there's a significant experience available for you guys in the amends process." And we're going like, we thought he was like a mind reader. We're like, how does this guy know that? You know, and it's like, well, it's because nearly all of us have a significant experience available in the amends process, you know. But the sad thing about it is most of the advice in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is geared toward not having to make the amends. If you got an amends you don't want to make, all you got to do is go over to the AA clubhouse and talk about it. Talk to 2 or 3 people. Somebody will tell you why you don't have to do it. You know, But when you listen to people telling their AA stories, the most magical, God-filled stories are these incredible stories that come out of the amends process and how people got set free and that sort of thing. But you know, there's more. There's a thing where it says don't leave. When we do the amends, let me back up a little bit. It says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And it talks about don't lead with a chin going in. But when we get our, what we do when we take our list is we put them on the cards. We have these little 3x5 index cards, and you don't have to do this, but this is just what we do. And Mark did. And what we did, and when I started working with Mark there at 17 years sober, I had 42 amends when I made that list. And so I'd write them all on a card, and you'd write, you know, my ex-wife and her contact information. Here's the harm. And then we ask 3 questions. We say, "Have I harmed you in any other way?" And we put, "Shut up and listen." And then the next question is, "Do you want to tell me how this made you feel?" Shut up and listen. In fact, I just put S-U-A-L now. And then the third one was, "Is there anything you could tell me that might help me make this right for you?" You know, shut up and listen. And the power of that, "Have I harmed you in any other way?" I mean, because one of the things Mark used to say was that part of living a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness is I have very little awareness of my effect on other people. You know, so you ever look up and somebody's hurt, somebody's crying, and you know, you're like, what? You know, so one time, Katie says, okay, tell this story. I made amends to Katie, and let me tell you, we were best friends for 20 years, and then we dated for 6 years before we got married because I needed a lot of training. God bless her, because I stand before you some of Katie's best work, you know, because I was a complete dog when we got together. And, you know, and when I look back at some of my behavior back then, I'm like, what's she so upset about? And you look back on it now, and you go, I cannot believe I said that, you know. But I sat down with Katie one time, and I had a list of amends to make to her. And I sat there, and I read all my amends to her. And then at the end of the amends, I said, you know, Katie, as self-centered as I am, there's a very good chance that I've done things to you that I'm not aware of. So if you'd like to take some time and make a list, I'd be willing to sit down with you and have another conversation like this. And she goes, thanks. That's great. I'd love to do that. So I go gooning off on my happy little way like I got good sense, you know. And one day, am I the only guy that likes to bring up the dumbest stuff we've ever done? You know, I mean, like we're in conversation one day, I go, remember that time I and she goes, oh yeah, I remember. I remember that one. And she goes, that's on the list. I'm like, what list is that, darling? And she goes, you told me I could make another list. I went, oh, now hold up. I meant like a few days, you know, or this was 7 months later, you know, and that whole, I don't know this, but that whole 7 months, every time I'd do something stupid, every time I'd hurt her feelings, every time, she'd write that down the list and she'd put that down here, and then she'd go, you know, and she had this Rolodex in her head. For the young people in the room, a Rolodex is what we used to keep information on. It had, you would put stuff on pieces of paper, and they would... They would spin around, but Katie said she had this Rolodex in her head that every time she'd go, well, that's like the time you touch that waitress, and that's the time you do this, and you know, and the thing I didn't see coming is now the cat's out of the bag, so we had to sit down and go over that list, and let me tell you something, we sat at the corner of the table, and she had 32 items on that list. Every one of them was a legitimate harm, and not one of them was on my amends list to her. That's the power of that question, have I harmed you in any other way? You know, and the thing that she told me to report to you is the thing she didn't see coming is after we did that exercise, that Rolodex went away. She wasn't referencing all that stuff anymore. She was set free as a result of that process. Now, she did also tell me that the other day she said, I think it might be time to make another list, you know. But it talks about, you know, your man is sure to be impressed by a sincere desire to set right the wrong. And, you know, so now when we get through that, we read the ninth step promises. I'm not going to read the ninth step promises. We read them way too many times. But one of the things I like to point out is that is anybody familiar with the bedevilments on page 52? They're worth looking at, and the bedevilments are the exact opposite of these ninth-step promises. But when you get down to the bottom, the ninth-step promises, it says God's doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. There's an interesting line here. It says, are these extravagant promises? And it says, we think not. You know who we is? In the foreword to the first edition of the Big Book, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So the book is written from the perspective of people that have recovered as a result of this process. And to them, these don't seem like extravagant promises. But when I'm sitting there with a brand new Big Book and 4 days of sobriety, you're damn right these are extravagant promises. You know, alone at perfect peace and ease, or is it the chatter of 1,000 monkeys? You know, I mean, to go from where my brain was when I come in to where this is talking about here is a monumental spiritual awakening. But it says, they're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. We've covered a lot of ground. it says this thought brings us to step 10. What thought? The thought that these things will materialize if we keep to working for them. And it says, it suggests that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So while I'm making amends, I start doing this way of living here. And it says, we've entered the world of the Spirit. How about that for a topic for a discussion meeting? It's better than gratitude. You know, I mean, have I entered the world of the Spirit? Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I looked up function, and it said, you know what it said for function as a definition? It said expected duty. Something's function is what a toaster, its function is I drop bread in it, and it cooks it and pops it back up. That's what I expect it to do. And it says my next expected duty is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. How can I be more understanding? How can I be more effective when I'm working with people? How would it have worked if you'd approached me with the same situation? And it gives me, in the 10th step, it gives me four things to watch for, and it gives me four things to do about it. But the funny thing is, when you look at the 10th step off the wall, it looks like damage control. It looks like stuff that you do when you fouled up. But wouldn't it be interesting if a sponsee called me up occasionally and said, hey, boss, here's what I'm thinking about doing. Does it seem selfish or dishonest to you? But it never happens like that. You know, they always go out, blow up the world. I called her again. I know you said not to go by there, but I went by there, and you know, and so I get to clean it up. You know, so we're trying to move it to maybe you could run some of this by me on the front end, but. When we're doing 10 steps, I live in pages 60 to 63. I mean, I think my sponsor is about to go, oh, no, I got a sponsor that's only read 3 pages out of the big book. You know, because it's always what usually, I could just pick up the phone and have to go, let me guess, Chris, the show didn't come off very well. And well, no, it didn't, you know, and then, you know what she did, or you know what she said, you know, and that sort of thing. So we're looking for these common themes, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. These are common things that we're going to work for in our work. But the four things it tells me to look for in the 10th step is selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Now, when it says to watch for these things, it's like being a sentry in the army. There's a big difference between watching for the enemy and waiting for the enemy. If I'm on watch, my job is to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, the things, the manifestations of self that are going to come back and block me. You know? And then the four things we do about it says we ask God to remove them. We talk to somebody else about it. Our buddy Danny says, ask God to remove them. And then we talk to somebody else. Danny says, we go to the throne before we go to the phone. it's like, you know, because I like to talk on the phone, but here's saying, take it to God and then talk to somebody else about it. And this is make amends quickly if we've harmed anybody and turn our thoughts to somebody we can help. Now, that's not always I'm going to run down and 12-step somebody. Sometimes if I meet somebody this weekend and says, my brother's got cancer or I'm going in for surgery this week, I'll pray for that person or I'll think about them. Right? You know, turn my thoughts to somebody I can help because it just gets me out of self long enough to maybe get some grace back in there. You know, and this is love and tolerance is our code. You know what it says? Code is a way of living, a set of rules or laws as a way of living. And the hard thing is it has to apply to everybody or it's not a code. It says love and tolerance of others is our code. That's a formal 10th step. When I call, and sometimes I'll call somebody or the guy, and I go, now, you just want to talk about this or are you doing a 10th step? I need to do a 10th step on it because then we're going to look at where I'm looking for where they were selfish, dishonest, resentful, afraid, and I'm going to bring God into it, and we're going to talk about whether they need to, where they make a decision based on self that later placed in a position to be harming. But I picked up a sponsee. Now, keep in mind, this guy was in his fourth decade of sobriety when I started working with him. Had never done a 10th step, and when we talked about the 10th step, he goes, well, for Pete's sake, if I was to call you every time I got selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid, I'd be calling you 50 times a day. I said, okay, start with one. Just give me one. you know, because we will look at the enormity of the project and just shut the whole thing down. I said, just give me one, and we'll work on that one, and then we'll think about it when the next one comes up. You know, that sort of thing. So that's the 10th step, and the 10th step promises are just amazing, but we don't have time to talk about them. You know, Mark used to talk a lot about that position of neutrality, safe and protected. But the one thing worth noticing in the 10th step is that nowhere does it talk about evening review. You know, and it's become a common mistake in AA to go, when I was doing my 10th step evening review. 10th step has nothing to do with evening review. You do the whole 10th step exercise, and then it goes into the setup for the step 11. Then the evening review starts on the next page in the 11th step. But in the setup, it says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. The only time in the book that it talks about something easy is to screw up. You know, it never says it's easy to face these things or anything like that. But it says we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Here you go. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How about just Tuesdays? You know, what if we just took Tuesdays and carried a vision of God's will into all our activities? How can I best serve thee? These, thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. How about occasionally? You know, I mean, how can I best serve thee? And so it says, much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from those him who has all knowledge and power. We're going to roll into the 11th step, but it says step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. There's a line here where it says we shouldn't be shy about this matter of prayer. I'm not shy about prayer. I pray all the time. I pray for people. I pray with people. And one of my favorite times to pray is when, you know, one thing that triggers a prayer for me instantly is when I hear somebody go, but I know there's nothing I can do about it. And I go, oh, yes, there is. You can pray about it. And prayer changes things. I've seen it happen too many times to think it's a coincidence. One of the things we work with is this positive prayer. And I've had guys that are having a terrible beef at work. They're going to have to quit their job or their home group. And I go, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pronounce it the way you want it to be and then thank God like it's already happened. You know, so we go, you know, Bob and I have a great work relationship at work based on mutual respect. We support each other and we're out for the good of the company. And we have a great time at work and we're supportive of each other like good friends. And God, I want to thank you for that. And I go, don't wait till you believe it. Just say it. Just do it in the morning, do it in the afternoon, and call me. And I swear to God, this guy called me up and he goes, it's like somebody else inhabited his body, you know? I mean, and there was another guy that was having trouble with his home group, and I told him to do it. And the guy just completely blew his mind the next time I saw him, and he goes, that's a bunch of bull. Charlie just called him and told him to be nice to me. And I was like, I didn't call him, dude. I mean, prayer changes things. It changes the energy that's out there, and there's bigger stuff going on there. But it says we shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Then it goes into the evening review. And the thing I want to say about the evening review real quickly is that look at what it tells me to look for in the evening review. Remember the 10th step, what we're supposed to watch for during the day? Well, here it says, were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do I owe an apology? Have I kept something to myself I should have talked to somebody about? Was I kind and loving towards all? So when you look at it like that, the evening review is really just a review of how'd you do with your 10th step during the day. Did you watch for those four things? Did you do the four things about it? And was your code love and tolerance? And then after that, we bring God into it, where it says we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid self-reflection. That would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. So now I've done my evening review. I've got these corrective measures. I go to bed, and I roll those corrective measures into my morning meditation. You know, and it says, on awakening, let us consider the 24 hours ahead. And I'm like a general planning a battle. I'm thinking, that's what it said in the 1936 dictionary, to meditate, like a general meditates a battle. Okay, we're going to go in like this, and I'm going to send some guys out here so we don't get flanked, and if they come in like this, we'll fight. So that's the way I'm thinking about my day. I'm going to go to work, and then it says, it's asking especially to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest or self-seeking motives. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. That one hit me hard one time because my whole life, my thought life was the sum total of reality. Eckhart Tolle talks about being able to step outside the thinker and watch your thing. And man, now I'm looking at it and I'm like going, wow, look what happens when Charlie's scared. Look what happens when Charlie feels shame. Oh my God, Katie had to point that one out to me. If I experience shame, I'll kill both of us. You know, I mean, I just, you know, I didn't even know it. She goes, wow, do you have a big reaction to shame? All it takes is somebody to go, Charlie. And I'm like a hockey player throwing those gloves off, you know. You know, because I can't deal with it, you know. And you know, and so it's asking that I be divorced from those things. But now you can watch that thought life and go, wow, what's driving me? Why do I have such a strong reaction to that thing? And we start to know. So in thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or decision. Here's a counterintuitive one. It says we relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. You know, something came to me one time, because this kind of restates the deal I made in step three, that God would give me what I need if I stay close to him. But, you know, I would always, my whole life, I would always said things are going to be, you hear some guys, you know, they'll go, well, I know I got this trouble, but I think it's going to be okay. And I'm like, what if it already is okay? What if it's okay just like it is? And I had this realization that my whole life, I've been waiting for things are going to be okay when this happens. Things are going to be okay when I get a console color television. Things are going to be okay when I get a girlfriend. Things are going to be okay when I get a waterbed. Things are going to be okay when I get... We're going way back. Things are going to be okay when I have children. Things are going to be okay when my children are gone. You know, I mean, you know, and I had this realization one day that all these things, it's going to be okay when this. I thought, what happens if I look up and I'm 80 years old one day and I'm looking back over my life and I go, son of a bitch, it was okay the whole time and I didn't even know it. How much time have I wasted in that process? It says we'll have this intuitive thought. We'll come to rely upon it. And then we conclude the period of prayer with a period of meditation with the prayer that we'd be shown all through the day. We just got about two more minutes left. That we'd be shown all through the day what my next step is to be. That I'd be given whatever I need to take care of such problems, the ones we've mentioned about having indecision about. And we ask for freedom from self-will. Once again, it restates the deal I made in step three. It's like a route map of an air carrier, you know, all these lines that go back to their hub city, all these lines in the big book take me back to the deal I made in step three. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful, ask for the right, I call it PARS, pause when agitated or doubtful, ask for the right thought or action, constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, saying to ourselves many times each day, that will not mine be done. And it says it works. It really does. You know, back in that third step deal we started off talking about, it says we had to quit playing God. Why? Because it says it didn't work. But this here, it says it works. It really does. You know, back on page 53, the book says something interesting. It says, we agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to reasonable approach and interpretation. But here it says it works. It really does. You know, and Mark used to talk about the disciplines of 10 and 11, the disciplines of 10 and 11, the disciplines of 10 and 11. When I'm practicing the spiritual disciplines of 10 and 11, when I'm living within the disciplines of 10 and 11, the disciplines, you know. And I'm sitting there in that workshop, and I'm not even in the same area code as the strict spiritual disciplines of step 10 and 11. I wish he would just stop saying that. But it says we alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way we've just outlined in the last 50-something minutes, 60-something minutes. It says, but this is not all. There's action and more actions. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. What if we really did all this stuff? How much better would our lives be if we just practiced a basic, fundamental AA program? Not constantly reminding ourselves, occasionally reminding ourselves. You know, saying to ourselves, once a day, thy will not mine be done. How much better would our lives be? I was at the Northland Club in Austin one day. I'm going to close with this story. I was in, it was around Christmas, and it was one of those meetings, you know, where everybody's talking about Christmas, and everybody's talking about the holidays, and everybody's talking about how to go back and see your family, and how to be around your family, and what do you do when they're drinking at the Christmas parties, and what do you, and there's all these tricks and tools and stuff, and about two-thirds of the way of the meeting, this old-timer that's just still one of my heroes, Ed O.D., raises his hand, and he goes, "You know, we don't have a special program for Christmas." He said, "We have a design for living that tells us what to do when we get up in the morning, what to do when we go to bed at night, and what to do all through the day, every flipping day of the year. It's a design for living that really works." I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic.